Hello, listeners, and welcome to Iris and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 16th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast from KCRG in Cedar Rapids. Plan on another warm one with highs into the 80s all across eastern Iowa. There are showers off to the west this morning, and while these pose a low threat to our northwest zone, the remainder of the area will stay dry and quiet through the evening hours. Going into the weekend, scattered storms are still on track. Given that this pattern will have a June look and feel to it, most of the storm chances will be in the overnight and morning hours, with substantial lulls in the activity expected each afternoon. This being said, any storm complex that develops overnight this weekend will carry the potential for heavy rainfall. Early next week, the warmth continues with highs pushing 90 by Tuesday. The stories on the front page of the Courier today include railroad strike stopped for now, Cedar Falls tracks should be removed, and we begin reading the top story, mental health, Regents Focus. Regents seek $1 million from the state for universities mental health needs, story written by Vanessa Miller, and begins with a photograph of the campus at UNI and students gathering together in small groups. Dateline Cedar Falls. After talking with student leaders over breakfast Thursday about challenges their campuses are facing, Iowa Regents, just hours later, upped their state funding request by $1 million to address mounting mental health needs and to support expanded mental health services. The extra $1 million, which, if granted, would go straight to the board office for allocation across University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and the University of Northern Iowa campuses, brings the region's total education appropriations ask for the next budget year to $611.5 million. That total represents a 35.7% million-dollar bump over the board's current $575.9 million in education appropriations, marking its steepest request increase in state funding in nearly a decade. Quote, in recognition of the concerns related to the need for additional mental health services expressed by our student leaders at the breakfast this morning, I'd like to propose an amendment to this request, Regent Abby Crow said, before the board voted on its legislative funding request for the next budget year, which starts July 1, 2023. Crow is the one student regent on the 9-member board, currently enrolled at UI and working as a nursing assistant at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. During Thursday's Board of Regents meeting at UNI, presidents of each of the Iowa public universities spoke about how they would use their cut of the funding increase, should lawmakers grant it, something that hasn't happened in full in years. Excluding the extra $1 million for mental health services, the board is proposing for fiscal 2024 an additional $12 million in new higher education support, each for UI and ISU, and $8 million in new higher education funds for UNI. In addition to moderate increases in support for its special schools operations, the board also is asking for $2 million in new funding for UNI's recently launched community college collaboration, allowing Iowans who've earned an associate degree from any of the state's 15 community colleges to earn a bachelor's degree from the university by taking courses online. Prior to its UNI at IACC initiative launch over the summer, which already has increased UNI's transfer numbers this fall, the Cedar Falls campus had established relationships with 4 community colleges, including Des Moines Area Community College and Indian Hills Community College. If granted, that extra $2 million would enable UNI to add student support services at 4 additional community colleges focused on plugging students into the new program. UNI President Mark Nook told the Regents on Thursday. As for its $8 million more in higher education appropriations, UNI committed to use half to further its teacher training programming, scaling up recruitment of future educators to meet the teacher shortage in Iowa. The other half would go to help further differentiate its tuition from UI and Iowa State. As UNI aims to compete less with those sister institutions and more with other regional universities in neighboring states that more closely align with its model, where UNI's resident undergraduate tuition and fees total is only $832 below UI and Iowa State. The difference in rates between public research universities and regional comprehensive institutions in Minnesota, Illinois, and Wisconsin, for example, ranges from nearly $3,300 to $5,500. Quote, "We want to continue to differentiate ourselves in tuition, and the $4 million we're asking for tuition differentiation is to help us keep our tuition as low as possible," Nook said. Quote, "We would really love to keep that flat, if at all possible, but it does depend on having the resources to be able to meet the commitments that we have to our students to provide them a high-quality education," unquote. Should the state grant UI its full $12 million appropriations increase, UI President Barbara Wilson on Thursday said her institution would use a big chunk of that, $7 million, to address the nursing shortage in Iowa. Of that, $6 million would go toward renovating and increasing its nursing simulation training space. The other $1 million would go toward hiring 10 new faculty with the goal of adding 48 nursing students a year. The hope, Wilson said, is to have 208 students per graduating class by 2026, amounting to a 30% increase over 40 years. Quote, "We know we can do that with the right funding and the right support on the faculty and simulation side," she said. UI promises to commit the other $5 million in increased appropriations to educating more first-generation students, the growing sector of Iowa's population angling to be the first in their family to attain a post-secondary degree. Iowa State, in discussing its plans for $12 million in new funding, also would spend some on supporting first-generation students, about $2 million. Another $4 million would support ISU students pursuing in-demand programs in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. $1 million would support mental health needs and economic growth, and the remaining $5 million would support research and innovation in specific areas of ISU expertise. Next, Andy Malone wrote this story, "Unused railroad tracks through Cedar Falls could be removed," and it opens with a photograph of two people crossing the street and, as they're doing so, walking across railroad tracks. The caption says, "Pedestrians cross the railroad tracks that run through 5th Street in Cedar Falls on Thursday. The Cedar Falls City Council is considering a proposal to remove the unused railroad track that runs through downtown. Dateline Cedar Falls. A new federal grant opportunity could lead the city of Cedar Falls and Iowa Northern Railroad Company to remove and relocate unused railroad tracks that have traversed the area for decades. The Cedar Falls City Council meets Monday to consider submitting an application for $9.76 million in funding from the Federal Railroad Administration's Railroad Crossing Elimination Program, which is made possible through the bipartisan infrastructure law. Approximately 11,642 linear feet of track runs near the intersection of Iowa and West First Streets, next to the First Street McDonald's, through the downtown area and several hundred feet past Cedar Falls Utilities to an area near Pfeiffer Springs Park off Grand Boulevard. Up to 24 crossings would be impacted. Removal of the track would purportedly better safety for pedestrian and automobile traffic. The CFU Board of Trustees discussed the proposition Wednesday at its monthly meeting. The track has not been used for its primary purpose since 2010, the delivery of coal to the municipal utility. CFU considers coal to be a backup fuel. It supports the project, and if it were to need coal beyond what is already stockpiled, executives expect it would be delivered by truck. Right now, the track is used very little, only for the storage of railroad cars, according to Iowa Northern Railway General Manager William Magee. According to city meeting documents, the railroad company brought the newly announced federal program to the attention of city officials several weeks ago. If submitted and awarded, the grant would provide $9.76 million, or 80% of the expected $12.2 million cost. The city and railroad company would split the 20% match, or what equals to $1.22 million each. One other option, besides abandoning the track and selling the right-of-way to the city or another interested party, would be to find a customer to locate along the spur that would produce the required revenue to offset the cost of maintenance and produce a respectable profit, unquote. That possibility is the least desirable of the three, as more frequent rail traffic in downtown can get very disruptive to commerce, operation of schools, public safety, and general operations of the city of Cedar Falls, wrote city staff in a letter to the council. Quote, city employees that were around for the last coal delivery in 2010 recall many problems and complaints regarding the long line of train cars, which isolated downtown for a significant amount of time. Right now, the rail is considered a trapped asset, said the letter. By relocating it outside of the city, it would lend Iowa Northern more capacity for its operations without disruption to the city residents, workers, and visitors. The project would include railroad removal and relocation, street and landscaping restoration, closure of a flood wall, creation of a trail connection, the city's right-of-way purchases, and relocation of a rail yard near Shell Rock. The council would discuss the sources of funding for its match when finalizing its next capital improvements plan. But the early projection is revenues from tax increment financing and local option sales tax would be used. And speaking of railroads, this next story, tentative labor deal averts rail strike for now, was written by Tom Barton and begins with a photograph of a Canadian Pacific train. And the story begins, train shipments of grain, fertilizer, lumber, produce, and fuel will not come to a screeching halt on Friday, as a strike that could have idled freight and passenger trains across the state and the country seems to have been averted for now. After some 20 hours of negotiations, railroad leaders and unions announced a tentative agreement Thursday morning that at least paused a pending national rail strike that had the potential to shut down rail shipments across a variety of industry sectors and hobble already struggling supply chains. Iowa Democrats said the proposed deal would provide better pay, improved working conditions, and peace of mind for railroad workers in the state around their health care costs, echoing a statement from President Joe Biden announcing the tentative agreement early Thursday morning. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican representing Iowa, meanwhile cautioned in a Senate floor speech that there's no guarantee that union members, who have been furious with employers for years over working conditions, will ratify the agreement. If they don't, Grassley said Congress must step in and force railroad workers and companies to accept recommendations from a White House panel to avoid a strike that would affect millions of Americans. Quote, the alternative is unacceptable, Grassley said. Quote, a railroad strike would plunge us back into the supply chain issues that have just now started to improve, he said. These trains carry the food we eat, the gas for our tanks, and the energy that heats our homes. Already I'm hearing from grain elevators that they're having trouble transporting feed. Hazardous cargo, such as the chlorine that cities need to purify drinking water, stopped moving earlier this week due to the potential strike, and Amtrak canceled long-distance passenger train routes that run on tracks owned, maintained, and dispatched by freight railroads. Quote, but this is just the tip of the iceberg unless they agree to a long-term deal, Grassley said. Quote, the last thing we need is for grain shipments to grind to a halt right as farmers are trying to harvest their crops. Iowa corn and soybeans can't feed the world if they are stuck on the farm, unquote. An official for one of the unions that represent engineers and conductors in Iowa said railroad workers in the state had yet to see specifics of the tentative agreement, but that workers were quietly optimistic. The Transportation Division of the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers, or SMART-TD, has roughly 700 members in the state, mainly train conductors and some engineers. Quote, I'm glad that they've reached a voluntary tentative agreement before the deadline was reached, said Christopher Smith, Iowa State Legislative Director for SMART-TD. We know that the agreement is good enough that membership can ratify a vote and go from there, unquote. Smith said he was hesitant to say too much about the agreement and the threat of a possible strike as negotiations continue. U.S. freight railroad workers were close to striking over claims that grueling schedules, strict on-call policies, and poor working conditions have been driving employees out of the industry over the past several years, a major sticking point in the labor dispute between rail companies and the unions. Was the adoption of a points-based attendance policy by some carriers. Those policies penalized workers up to termination for going to routine doctor's visits or attending to family emergencies. Conductors and engineers say they can be on call for 14 consecutive days without a break and that they do not receive a single sick day, paid or unpaid. Rail employees remained on the job throughout the pandemic, often working mandatory overtime to compensate for staff cuts and departures. But note they have gone without a raise for 3 years, while rail companies saw record profits in 2021, and stock buybacks have boosted shareholder values. The railroad and unions have been negotiating a new contract since 2019. SMART-TD's Smith also pointed to a paragraph in a report issued by a presidential emergency board appointed by Biden to help resolve the labor contract dispute between major freight railroads and unions. The paragraph states that the rail companies believe, quote, that capital investment and risk are the reasons for their profits, not any contributions by labor. It also says the carriers assert that since employees have been fairly and adequately paid for their efforts, and do not share in the downside risks if the operations are less profitable, then they have no claim to share in the upside either. Smith said the statements riled union membership that has worked through the pandemic and now works hard to maintain the railroad in the place it is, unquote. Quote, that is still a troubling statement that we have to work to get past, he said. So hopefully this agreement is good and we can move forward. Smith said members were largely reserving judgment until they have a chance to see the exact wording and get briefed on the tentative agreement, which could take a couple of days. We quietly are remaining optimistic, he said. We have faith in our national bargaining team that if they're coming back saying they have something that's worthwhile to potentially ratify, we're entrusting them to bring forward a good contract, unquote. One Pleasant Hill Railroad worker with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, who did not wish to be identified, said he was still processing and trying to understand the details of the proposed deal, but that he heard from workers who were not pleased. The worker said that, if implemented, the agreement still would contribute to attrition and health and safety problems, and that it does not address current labor concerns needed to bring a better functioning rail network and supply chain. Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn, however, called the tentative agreement an important win for our economy and Iowans. Quote, so the bottom line is that rail workers deserve a fair contract, Wilburn told reporters Thursday, noting his brother is a retired rail worker. A fair contract and bargaining in good faith is critical. Quote, but regardless of what happens, this tentative agreement ensures that rail workers will get better pay, improved working conditions, and peace of mind around their health care costs, unquote. Iowan's lone Democrat in Congress, U.S. Representative Cindy Axne of West Des Moines, applauded rail union leaders for reaching a tentative agreement on a new contract that will avoid a work stoppage. Quote, it's disappointing that union leaders had to fight so hard for fundamental and reasonable demands, such as unpaid time off, so their members could visit the doctor or take care of loved ones without penalty, Axne said. Quote, while this agreement still needs to be ratified, I am optimistic this process will keep our goods moving and give a raise and better working conditions for the men and women who work day in and day out to provide for their families and help Iowa farmers and businesses get their goods to market. Now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section, and the first article is titled, Supervisors Approve Projects Using Federal Funds and Ask Further Questions. And Maria Cooper wrote this story, Dateline Waterloo. The lack of precedence for distributing American Rescue Plan Act dollars is causing questions to arise among members of the Blackhawk County Board of Supervisors. The supervisors approved 12 county projects to be paid for with the federal funds on Tuesday. The county received more than $25 million and has $11 million earmarked for projects, leaving about $15 million to be allocated. Quote, if we don't use all of this, I feel like we're negligent as a board and not utilizing it to the benefit of our local residents, Supervisor Dan Trelka said. Quote, we've got some work to do, and let's start utilizing this funding that will benefit all of our taxpayers, regardless of where they live. Let's make some decisions. Let's give the ARPA committee some direction, because I don't want to give one red cent back, unquote. Some of the initiatives include multiple wastewater and sewer projects, record digitization, information technology purchases, accessible playgrounds that are Americans with Disability Act compliant, and efforts that are intended to reduce crowding during in-person voting at the county elections office. Most of the projects were approved unanimously. However, with projects labeled as having a higher burden of proof, Supervisor Tom Little voted no. The designation indicated that it may be more difficult getting the project costs reimbursed with the federal money. These included replacing the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning system at the headquarters of County Conservation Department, a shower renovation at Blackhawk Park and Sigel Cow Park, and the Elections Workstations project. Michael Trennan, the assistant county attorney, said the types of projects that are ultimately approved relate to the existing COVID-19 pandemic and preparedness for possible future pandemics. Other projects that made an appearance at the meeting without prior board discussion included elevator improvements at Pinecrest, Secondary Roads Department computer equipment, and improvements at the county's health department. Trinan said there had been discussion about moving the department's clinic, but there are still a lot of questions to be answered. Supervisor Chris Swartz said a new public health clinic would be important for him. A priority for me coming out of this pandemic is improving the quality of those services, Swartz said. Now that we've got another pandemic we're dealing with monkeypox, we need to improve the quality of facilities we have. After public health concerns are addressed, he would like to fund water quality projects, community projects, and housing initiatives. Mayors from Evansdale, Elk Run Heights, LaPorte City, and Raymond were also present at the meeting. They are requesting some allocation of funds for their wastewater treatment facilities. The mayors from Elk Run Heights and Raymond already submitted a written proposal to the board, so the Evansdale and LaPorte City mayors were the only two who spoke at the meeting. Jamie Gaston, LaPorte City's mayor, said her city's wastewater costs have risen from $3 million to $10 million. She noted that right now, residents are paying $24 per month on debt service charges. Gaston asked for a $1 million allocation from the board. Deanne Kobliska, mayor of Evansdale, said residents there are paying an annual increase of $2.50 per month due to the Department of Natural Resources mandated projects. Supervisor Little argued the DNR requirement happened at least 4 years ago and said it would mandate fines if the city didn't take actions, saying it doesn't have anything to do with COVID. Kobliska said she disagreed with Little, saying because of COVID-19, prices are higher for things such as groceries and gas, and the additional spending is putting an extra burden on taxpayers. She also asked for a $1 million allocation. Maria Cooper wrote this next story, titled, African American Fest to be held in Waterloo on Saturday. Dateline Waterloo. Hopewell Missionary Baptist Church is hosting an African American Fest on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. It will take place on the corner of East 4th and Adams Streets by the African American Cultural Center. The Reverend Clarence Williams, an organizer of the event, said the purpose of the event is to build the community and draw attention to African American culture. Quote, we can come together at least once a year and enjoy being together, and we can do something positive for the community, Williams said. The event goes all day from 11 a.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. Williams said there will be a variety of fun activities for all ages, races, and genders, and the admission is free. Food and clothes vendors will be on site, as well as live entertainment all day long. For kids, there will be a magician, bouncy house, and candy bags. Williams also said there will be raffles throughout the day and lots of stuff for grown-ups as well. The event will take place near the African American Culture Center boxcar. Although not directly affiliated with the organization, Williams said it's important for people to understand the grounds the event is taking place on. Williams said all you need to do on Saturday is come together, have fun, and grow the community as one people. Our next story was also written by Maria Cooper. East Buchanan Schools received COVID-19 funding. Dateline Winthrop. The Iowa Department of Education and Health and Human Services awarded nearly $600,000 in grants to 10 school districts across the state. The funding is for training and coaching school health care workers on the overlap of COVID-19 and mental health. East Buchanan Community School District received almost $55,000. Other school districts awarded include Sheraton, Dubuque, Harlan, Iowa City, Logan, Magnolia, Mount Pleasant, North Mahaska, Muscatine, and Storm Lake. The grants can be used to cover costs associated with planning, training, and coaching, including travel expenses for up to 12 professional development opportunities. East Buchanan Superintendent Diane Fox said they will be putting more focus on Leader in Me, an education model that builds leadership and life skills. Quote, COVID-19 is detrimental to our social, emotional, behavioral health. Depression, anxiety, and fear have set in, Fox said in an email. We are looking for ways to not only rejuvenate our staff, but our students and community. We need to instill confidence back into our school community and make a difference. We need a change in our culture. The two state departments received $4.5 million from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Award amounts were based on the funding requested by each district to support their professional development plan. Priority consideration was given to those who did not receive additional federal funding to cover the cost of professional learning and coaching beyond what they have available through 3 rounds of federal elementary and secondary school emergency relief funds and the Elementary and Secondary Education Act school improvement funds, a news release said. Quote, the emotional health and academic growth of students are closely connected, said Ann Lebo, director of Iowa Department of Education, in the release. Quote, these additional resources will help schools expand their capacity for addressing the social, emotional, behavioral health needs of students, break down barriers to learning, and improve outcomes as we move forward, unquote. This was the third and final round of funding. A total of 17 districts were awarded over $1.3 million in the first two rounds. And now, listeners, we want to remind you that you're hearing the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Dennis Lee Sack, 74, of Nevis, Minnesota, passed away Saturday, September 3rd, 2022, at his home. He is survived by his wife, Diane Sack, of Nevis, father A.J. Sack, and brother Guy Sack, both of Cedar Falls, two daughters, Jennifer, spouse Warren, Scouten, and Katie, spouse Corey, Stenke, numerous grandchildren, and best friends, Dean and Becky Williams of Cedar Falls. Funeral services for Dennis are at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 1st, 2022, at Peace Lutheran Church in Nevis, Minnesota. Condolences may be left at ceasefuneralhome.com. Here the courier lists three death notices. Richard Thomas Huss, 93, died Wednesday, September 7th, 2022, at his home. Arrangements are with Cremation Society in Cedar Rapids. John G. Les, 94, of Independence, died Tuesday, September 13, 2022, at Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. Arrangements are being made with the Reif Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. And Catherine L. Ratliff, 81, of Independence, died Tuesday, September 13, 2022, at Buchanan County Health Center in Independence. Arrangements are being made with the Reif Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. And now let's turn to the opinion section. This editorial first appeared in the New York Times, and it's authored by Zeynep Tefeci, titled, "The New COVID Boosters Are Amazing News." For the first time, the United States is rolling out COVID vaccines updated to match variants that are currently dominant, as well as the original strain. This bivalent character will provide a better response not just to the most threatening variants today, but probably to future variants too, because when the immune system faces different versions of the same virus, it gets broader protections overall. This is terrific news, and there's more. Not only will a booster with the new vaccines decrease the likelihood of infection and severe illness and help reduce transmissions of the virus, it could also decrease the likelihood of developing long COVID. The bad news? The boosters are getting so little fanfare and so much unfounded skepticism that too few people might get them, and lots of people who need not get sick, suffer, or die will get sick, suffer, and die. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has said that a national survey found that 72% of respondents said they were likely to receive an updated booster, but to actually get them vaccinated requires making boosters easily accessible and making sure people know about their benefits. The White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, Ashish Jha, said last week that people might consider getting the booster when they get flu shots, which many do in October, and, barring a new variant curveball, think of it as an annual shot going forward. That's fine if people do that, especially since many immunologists say it's best to wait 3 to 6 months after one's last vaccination or infection, and many people have had recent infections. However, only about half of adults in the United States get the flu vaccine, and most haven't gotten the earlier COVID boosters. Without a vigorous outreach program and promotion, millions of Americans who are not anti-vaxxers but could still use a powerful nudge won't get this helpful dose. While booster rates have been dismal among Republicans, many of whom have adopted anti-vaccine stances, it is also many of the most vulnerable Americans, even those who got initial doses of vaccines, who are likely to be left behind. Those who haven't gotten earlier booster shots, despite having gotten earlier doses, were more likely to lack the health insurance, be Black or Hispanic, or be poorer or be less educated. Meanwhile, funding for distributing these vaccines has dried up amid congressional gridlock. Democrats did not put new pandemic funding in the March spending package because it could cut into stimulus funds for states, and they now face Republican resistance to new pandemic funding. There will most likely be fewer of the dedicated vaccine outreach centers that were set up before. Benjamin Mueller reported in the Times that local health departments are battling staffing shortages and the monkeypox outbreak and playing catch-up with childhood immunizations. Plus, some health officials seem to believe that it's enough to leave it up to individuals to seek these vaccines, mostly at private sites like pharmacies. There is only $550 million in vaccination spending allocated through FEMA so far this year, compared with $8.5 billion last year. Boosters are especially helpful for older adults or those with existing health issues, but such groups often face challenges navigating access. Last year, there were campaigns to bring vaccination to senior centers and convenient community locations, or to help people make it to vaccination centers, or even get vaccinated at home. White House officials tell me they will keep trying to carry out such campaigns, but acknowledge it will only be to the extent that dwindling resources allow. Without such support, how many of those at risk who would otherwise be willing will fail to get the booster? While young, healthy people have been vaccinated and had an uneventful breakthrough infection, are at much less risk of severe illness even without a booster, they might prefer to avoid getting sick or reduce their risk of long COVID. But beyond the personal benefits, despite common claims to the contrary, vaccines still help dampen spread, and boosters can further reduce transmission of the disease, including by reducing infections in the first place, and thus help protect especially the more vulnerable. Another survey conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that about a third of the people who got vaccinated but not boosted said they had not had the time to get it as a reason. That response was highest among Hispanic adults, with 41% citing it. About another quarter of respondents mentioned side effects. Paid time off following vaccination campaigns in workplaces, combining flu and COVID vaccines, could overcome this obstacle. Jha tells us the administration is already asking employers to carry out such steps, and it remains to be seen how many step up. Then, there's the information gaps. Most of those who got vaccinated but not boosted, and about a third of those who don't plan to get the updated booster, said they had enough protection from previous doses or past infections. Many who did not get the previous booster, and many who don't plan to get the updated one, say that they did not believe the boosters to be effective, a claim that is routinely made because Omicron caused a lot of breakthrough infections among the vaccinated. A straightforward message could rebut all of this. It's true that variants can cause breakthroughs, but vaccines still prevent serious illness and death, and even more so with boosters. Many European countries, and Canada, for example, did a better job of making sure more of their population got boosted. Their cumulative death and illness tolls from the Omicron wave are sharply lower than those of the United States, where only about a third of the eligible adults had gotten boosters, compared with two-thirds of adults in many European countries. Canada, for example, had 80% fewer deaths from the Omicron wave. A similar pattern holds globally. Countries like Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan have about 80% or more of their adult population boosted, and their death tolls are even lower. Many might also be wondering why bother with one more shot, since 68% of Americans have had two initial vaccination shots. Some of those have had booster shots already, and most likely about 60% of the country got some level of immunity from Omicron infection. Depta Bachara, an immunologist, told me that variants evolved to evade the first line of antibody protection generated by earlier vaccines or past infections, even though protections against severe disease remained fairly strong. But the new boosters can greatly decrease that evasion. When the initial vaccines were trialed matching the strain that was then in circulation, they reported 90% to 95% protection against any symptomatic infection, which then declined against variants and with time, while exact numbers remain to be seen. All the immunologists I spoke with told me the updated boosters should again increase such protections. Vaccines and boosters have already been shown to greatly reduce rates of long COVID among the infected, but obviously, if infection is avoided completely, that would directly sidestep the risk of long COVID. Shane Crotty, an immunologist, also noted that these boosters will probably further reduce the chances of more severe disease complications, which include long COVID, and says, quote, the higher your level of immunity, the less viral replication you're going to have, the less viral damage, the less likelihood of long COVID, unquote. And these new boosters can be expected to do even more going forward, including better protection against future variants by better training both antibodies and memory cells, which are different parts of the immune system. As Bachara told me, being exposed to different versions of the virus, as will happen with these updated boosters, further dampens and broadens the kind of antibodies that get generated, including ones that can work against future variants. Marion Pepper, an immunologist, told me a new variant vaccine can also, quote, create new, more diverse memory cells that will help protect from Omicron variants and new variants that we have yet to encounter, unquote. Unfortunately, we may face another problem we witnessed throughout the pandemic: public health officials or prominent media doctors casting doubt on the boosters by focusing on their imperfections rather than their immense benefits and worrying about public reaction, like concerns about vaccine fatigue. When I hear that phrase, I wonder how it would have sounded in the spring of 2020 when we had field hospitals in Central Park, bodies were stacked in trailers as funeral homes ran out of space and hospitals ran out of body bags. I've never understood the second guessing by public health authorities and doctors about how the public may or may not react. Why not just provide accurate, detailed information and make it easy to get vaccinated? That's the best response to vaccine fatigue, even if committed anti-vaxxers might remain hard to reach. It's likely that last fall and winter, fewer people got boosters, at least partly because some well-known scientists unfairly questioned the usefulness of the shots. That's how a similar dynamic with disproportionate attention on minor issues like booster mandates in colleges. Blanket mandates are now less necessary for college students, though some dorms may apply them to protect medically frail students or to provide other students with options. But young people should still be informed of the benefits of boosters, and older and medically frail people should still be strongly reminded of the continuing risks posed by COVID-19. White House officials say they will roll out their own messaging campaign to counter the confusion. Let's hope it works. There's much research on vaccine messaging, but most of it comes down to establishing trust, being honest and transparent, and making vaccination easier. Our terrible healthcare system is a major impediment. Having a regular relationship with a doctor can be a key factor, but many Americans don't have one. It's not surprising that among all groups, it's the uninsured who remain least likely to be vaccinated and boosted. As has been shown throughout the pandemic, it's vaccination, not vaccines, that save lives. And many more would be vaccinated if given information and easy access. Not having tools against diseases that cause so much suffering is one tragedy, but having them remain unused should be an unacceptable one. And now we turn to the sports page, and the lead story on that page is Farley just trying to fix UNI defense, college football. Farley just trying to fix defense against the Hornets, story filed by Ethan Petrick. And it begins with a photograph of Northern Iowa's Javon Brecky as he sacks Western Illinois University quarterback Connor Sampson on Saturday at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa head coach Mark Farley left little doubt about his priorities ahead of the winless Panthers matchup against number 8 Sacramento State. Quote, "I am just trying to fix our defense," Farley said. "We got a good offense coming in here." The UNI defense got off to a rough start against Air Force in week 1, as the Panthers gave up 691 yards of total offense, including 582 rushing yards, in a 48-17 loss. Last week, the defense showed flashes of what it could be as it held North Dakota to only 7 points in the first half of the play, but failed to get the Fighting Hawks offense off the field in the fourth quarter. Leading 29-27, UND gained possession following a UNI touchdown with 6:51 remaining in the game. The Fighting Hawks bled out the clock with a 12-play, 57-yard drive in which UND converted 2 third downs. During his weekly Monday press conference, Farley aired his frustrations with UNI's defensive performance, while also crediting the offense for keeping UNI in the game on Saturday. Quote, "Our offense countered right back," Farley said. "Then it was up to the defense to go out there and do what it should have done. We gave up the score, gave up the third down, a 3rd and 10. You know me, that does not bode well on defense. We have an offense that is putting enough points on the board to win. We have to clean up our defense, and we will," unquote. An inverse of previous season, Farley described the feeling of having a capable offense go blow for blow with an opponent. Quote, "It is a good feeling when you see our sideline with the confidence it has on offense," Farley said. "Whereas the defense is trying to hold up, just get one touchdown to win the game. Now, they are going up and down the field," unquote. Although frustrated with their overall performance, Farley noted that the Panthers' defense showed flashes of what it could be. He specifically pointed out UNI's ability to adjust to the passing attack of North Dakota from the ground-and-pound style of Air Force. Quote, "We did a good job last week getting them back into coverages that we needed to be in," Farley said. "This is an even better team throwing the football than last week. The personnel need to clean up their technique, and they will have the success that they expect to have. But they have to clean up the detail and their technique and still play at high speed," unquote. The UNI defense gets no reprieve as the 8th-ranked Sacramento State Hornets come to Cedar Falls for a rematch of last season's 34-16 UNI win. Quote, "This week is a huge challenge because it probably is the top throwing offense in FCS football," Farley said. "Where the top rushing offense was Air Force, the top throwing offense is at Sacramento State," unquote. In their opening game of the season against Utah Tech, another upcoming UNI opponent, the Hornets amassed 589 total yards of offense with 211 passing yards and 378 rushing yards. Led by a pair of talented, experienced signal callers, Sac State possesses the ability to beat a defense in a number of ways. Quote, "They have enough talent," Farley said. "They have enough firepower, and they have enough play-calling ability that they can line up against anybody and move the football." Both senior quarterbacks, Jake Dunaway and Asher O'Hara, took snaps on the Hornets' opening drive. O'Hara offers more of a threat with his dual-threat ability as the Illinois native rushed for 101 yards and a score on 12 attempts. However, he also added 56 yards and two touchdowns on a 5-for-7 passing. Last season, O'Hara aired it out 53 times for 338 yards on 32 completions against the Panthers. Dunaway fits the mold of the pocket passer with 141 yards and two touchdowns on 17-for-25 passing and only one rushing attempt for a 7-yard loss. While looking ahead on Saturday's matchup, Farley said the Hornets' offense functions at a high level, regardless of who lines up under center. Quote, "It does not matter which one plays. They are good," Farley said. Quote, "They won the Big Sky. They are a playoff football team last year. This is the Big Sky champion. This is not just any Big Sky team. This is a great conference." Defensively, the Hornets possess an aggressive, opportunistic defense, which forced 3 interceptions in the first quarter against the Trailblazers. All 3 turnovers led to touchdowns for the Hornets. While aggressive and opportunistic, Sac State allowed 506 passing yards and 3 touchdowns through the air. The Hornets' susceptibility to a strong passing game opens the door for UNI quarterback Theo Day to have an encore of his breakout performance last season. Day replaced Will McClellan under center at halftime against the Hornets, with the Panthers trailing 9-7. Day led a previously sputtering UNI offense to 27 points in the third quarter to secure a 34-16 victory. Quote, "In that particular game, he was new to everyone," Farley said. "We did not know him because he just got here in August. We did not know how he was going to perform. I remember making that decision at halftime. If we are going to see what is, let's see what he is here and not wait until mid-season. We gave him the first series and he scored," unquote. Farley said Day has continued to improve since taking over as the starter against Sac State 370 days ago. Quote, "What I have really noticed now is he is gaining confidence each game," Farley said. "He is playing well. He is getting the ball out on time. He is more confident in himself. He understands and has more of a connection with his receivers this year, and I think that is showing up in his play," unquote. Now let's read more local news from the Courier. CO2 pipeline foes challenge law granting surveyors access to land. This story is filed by Nick Hytrek, Dateline Sioux City. 2 Woodbury County landowners are challenging the constitutionality of a state law that permits surveyors for a proposed carbon dioxide pipeline to enter their property. William and Vicki Hulse of Moville filed a counterclaim in Woodbury County District Court on September 7th, asking a judge to declare the law unconstitutional and void. They also are seeking an injunction prohibiting agents of Navigator Heartland Greenway from entering their property until the constitutionality issue has been decided. They argue that Iowa Code 479B.15, which grants pipeline companies right of entry to private land to survey and examine it to determine a pipeline's depth and route, does not require just compensation to the landowner, quote, "which amounts to an unlawful taking in violation of Iowa's Takings Clause, and runs counter to the Iowa Constitution's protection of landowner property rights from unwarranted government intrusions," unquote. The challenge is response to a Navigator lawsuit in which the Dallas-based company is seeking an injunction to stop the Hulses from denying its agents access to survey their land, which lies in the proposed pipeline's route. The lawsuit also asks for the sheriff's office to ensure access is provided. In its suit, filed in August in Woodbury County District Court, Navigator says the Hulses have twice refused to grant a land agent access to their rural Woodbury County property. District Judge Jeffrey Neary has scheduled a hearing for Monday to hear arguments on the injunction. The Hulses' lawyer, Brian Jord of Omaha, on Wednesday filed a request to continue the hearing to a later date. No hearings have been scheduled on the counterclaim. Navigator has filed a similar lawsuit in Clay County against Sioux Rapids resident Martin Koenig, and two against landowners in eastern Iowa's Butler County. The company says Koenig has denied entry to his property three times, and in one instance, his spouse threatens to let the dogs go on agents attempting to enter their land to survey it. Jord has filed counterclaims similar to the one filed for the Hulses in Clay County and one of the Butler County cases. Navigator has proposed a $3 billion, 1,300-mile pipeline that would collect carbon dioxide from ethanol plants and fertilizer processors in Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Illinois, convert it to liquid form, and transport it under high pressure to a site in Illinois, where it would be pumped thousands of feet beneath the surface. The pipeline would run approximately 900 miles through 36 Iowa counties, including Woodbury, Clay, Butler, Bremer, and Buchanan counties. Other Siouxland counties include Plymouth, Lyon, Oskaloosa, O'Brien, Cherokee, Dickinson, and Buena Vista in Iowa, and Dakota, Dixon, and Wayne counties in Nebraska. Officials with both pipeline companies have said the pipeline would pump millions of dollars in property tax revenues into Iowa and add value to ethanol produced at facilities that have agreed to provide gas to the pipeline. The pipelines also would remove millions of tons of carbon from the atmosphere annually, benefiting the environment, the companies have said. And listeners, that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 16th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.